welcome to Rocket Talk. I'm Justin Landon, the host of a Tor.com podcast. Notice I no longer say the Tor.com podcast because Mavesh Murad's Midnight in Karachi launches this week. Highly suggest everybody check it out. She's already got guests like Audrey Niffinger and Megan Abbott lined up. But my guests are no slouches either, Mavesh. The gauntlet is thrown. Tonight I have Tina Connolly and Brad Bollier on the show to talk about stuff. I'm sure we'll get to something important as it goes along. Tina is the author of several novels from Tor Books, including Iron Skin, Copperhead, and Silverblind. Her fourth novel, Seriously Wicked, comes out next year from Tor Teen. She's published a lot of short stories over the years, but also narrates them for Podcastle, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and her own Parsec award-winning podcast, Toasted Cake. Hi, Tina.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I thought about putting my cake in a toaster, and I didn't think I'd have a lot of you know, success.
Okay. Well, the first thing is you need a toaster oven. Oh. It doesn't actually work that well with a pop-up toaster. So sorry to disappoint.
Well, there goes. You've just ruined my whole night.
I know.
Hung up from this call, I was going to go slice some birthday cake and stick it in. But all right. You know, if you want to ruin dreams. The other laugh there is Brad Bollier. He's the author of the Lays of Anaskaya trilogy. He's also published a collection of short fiction titled Lest Our Passage Be Forgotten and Other Stories. He's a former winner of Writers of the Future, and his forthcoming series from DAW begins with the 12 Kings of Sharakai next fall. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you. And it's clear that to be in this field nowadays, you have to have a podcast.
And of course, Brad, co-hosts Speculate, the podcast for writer, readers, and fans with Gregory Wilson.
That's right. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, Brad. I totally forgot your podcast and your bio. It's just because your bio was so extensive that
yes, exactly.
There just wasn't room to talk about your podcast as well.
You have to pick and choose.
Yes. Well, the Speculate was on my Hugo ballot last year, Brad, so cross your fingers. We'll see if we can get it there this year. You know, you and the 10 other podcasts that were on the
podcast. Yeah, exactly.
It is a lengthy list. So the two of you are joining me tonight because you're working on a collection of stories together in conjunction with some other authors, and we'll get to that in a bit. But first, I mean, you know, the elephant in the room is it is the weekend after Thanksgiving. I don't know about the two of you, but I'm pretty much useless at this point.
I'm kind of too. The holidays kind of, I don't know if worn out is the right word, but we, you know, I did cooking, not all of the cooking, but for my side of the family. And then we had my, the parents on Joanne's side over. And then the last 2 days, we've just been like kind of useless, just sitting around the house eating leftovers and watching football go pack. So yeah, I'm kind of like bushed and weirded out because it's a different schedule than I'm used to.
So I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, and we got on a plane several days ago, it seems like forever ago at this point, and we went to Kansas to see both sets of grandparents. And this has been a very delightful and very long adventure. That's about it, you know, tactfully as I can say it at this point. No, it's been great. But, you know, traveling with a 4-year-old and 1-year-old is not quite as easy as it was when we were just visiting the in-laws and the outlaws all on our own.
Tina, I have a 5-year-old and an 18-month-old, and we went to dinner and it was like open warfare. I mean, we sit down the street.
Oh, my God. Yes. And it seems like everything is upended. Once you've left home, they feel free to do anything, especially when you're meeting someone new. Like, you know, oh, the aunt and uncle you'd like to impress, or the cousins you'd like them to be polite to. All of a sudden, your children are acting like monsters, and you're like, where did you come from?
Now yeah, I know where all these shapeshifter stories are.
Yeah, we've never taken our kids 8 and 4 at this point. I'm sorry, 9, and just about to turn 5, almost the same age as your daughter. We've never taken them on a trip other than like a car trip, but we've never been on a plane together just because I fear that very thing, that they would be little monsters.
You know, the plane trip wasn't even as bad as... So my parents are in Lawrence, and then we took a day trip to Salina to visit some... to do a family thing, and then we went to the... other relatives, which are in a very small town. And like 10 minutes into the car trip, my daughter, the 1-year-old, is screaming because she has to sit next to my brother. And this, apparently this is the worst thing in the world. So 10 minutes into the trip, we have to pull over on the highway and switch places. And then 10 minutes later, we have to pull over again because my son has thrown up.
So, oh, no.
longest day in the world. The car trip, I think, is even worse than the plane trip.
There's probably been very little writing accomplished over the last 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, no.
Well, I'm in edit mode, so I've actually done a lot. I owe my final edits for the first book in my new series to Daw soon. So I just finished up the final edits this morning, and then right after this, I'm gonna plow into the final polish draft. So I've actually gotten quite a bit done.
Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, I kind of checked into Twitter today, and I took one look at it, and I was like, oh shit! I missed everything. I have no idea what's going on, I'm just gonna pretend that the last week didn't happen.
That's a good plan.
At least in terms of this world, I've been so occupied with family and such. But anyway, before we did this podcast, and I did find time to do this over the last couple of days, the two of you sent me a few pieces of short fiction that you've both written that are going to be parts of this collection that y'all are working on, just called 6x6, and we'll talk about the collection in a little bit. But first I want to talk about these pieces that you sent me, and I was really struck by how narratively driven they were. And that seems just silly, right? Because, like, there are stories. Of course they're narratively driven, Justin. I do read quite a bit of short fiction, and it seems like oftentimes, especially at short stories, which is, 5,000 words-ish, under 7,500 words, I guess, is the technical definition, they aren't always about that. A lot of times they're about language, or about some theme, or about making a point of some kind, primarily in the narrative and character second. And yet, as I read the stories that you all wrote, they seem to me to be stories first, narrative first, and then the other stuff second. And that still feels unique to me in short fiction. Am I crazy?
I don't think you are. So one of the things when we talked a little bit before the show about this subject, I was thinking about a trip I took out to Utah. I went to a convention with a small conference out there that I was invited to, and I was talking a bit about short fiction with Paul Jeunesse, and we got on the subject of, like, comparing short fiction to longer fiction, and it seems to me that short fiction is, it's a little bit insular, and it's, you're rewarded, a little bit for going outside of the box. And I think that's partially why you see some of the different styles and a very wide range of styles in short fiction. Whereas in, longer fiction and novels and such, you are not rewarded for being, outside the box. You're rewarded for being inside the box largely. Because the editors are looking for, like, the next, new thing that's like the old thing that everyone loved. And so, yeah, I don't think you're off base. I think that is true of short fiction to some degree, that it's a place where, you can experiment, but also people like that experimentation. Whereas in like novel length, maybe they don't so much.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting because actually one of the things I think about my own fiction is that sometimes it isn't as narrative driven as the novels per se. But as you mentioned, my flash fiction podcast earlier, I actually spend a lot of time thinking about what makes very short stories work. And as you mentioned, when you get to a very short story, you almost, a lot of times some of the stories I run don't have anything to do with narrative at all. You have a lot of room to be experimental in a short story versus a novel. You have even more room to be experimental in a flash fiction piece. And so you find, I think, as you go down the length of what you're writing, perhaps because you're taking up less of the reader's time, you have more freedom to play and experiment and to do things that wouldn't work at a longer length.
Yeah, and I think I'll admit, on this podcast that I came from a novelist mindset, I think, when I came to fiction. And I started going to, Kiz Johnson did these workshops at Gen Con a long time ago. And I started going to those. And if you know Kiz, she's just a brilliant short story writer. And I tried to sort of fit that mold of being a short story writer just to learn. That was one of her big takeaways from those talks, was to use short fiction as an avenue to teach yourself how to write, and they don't, the two forms are different, so they don't always translate well. Not everything translates between the two, but a lot of things do. So what I tried to do, frankly, was distill a longer work into a short tale. And I think I'm still in that mode. I try to get away from it a bit, but I think I'm, I'm still along those lines where I'm trying to take a little bit of a slower pace than some of the short stories that I read are like, and more grounded than some of them are too. I don't experiment as much. And so maybe that's where some of that's coming from too, Justin.
Tina, you mentioned flash fiction a little bit, and the flash fiction piece, I think that most people will be most familiar with, at least I consider it flash fiction. It may not actually be, but the Rachel Swirsky's Hugo nominated story last year and Nebula nominated too, I believe, as well, which is If You Were a Dinosaur, My Love, which is a very, very short story. And as I read that, and I think about what you were saying, was there isn't a lot of, their characters are basically non-existent. You know one thing about them or maybe two things about them. The story is, person gets beat up, significant other is upset about it and expressing that anger, and that's the story. There really isn't a plot there. There really is, the characters are very basic, but it's just a game that the story's playing sort of with itself and with the reader.
Yeah, that is such a beautiful story. And I think, to me, that's one of the things I talk about in flash fiction is that you can do a lot with sort of pyrotechnics, and that's almost like a pyrotechnic story. She's found herself a new structure that she's working with, and she builds you a whole story just out of that sort of form that she uses. And that one also reminds me of another story I love that was on the Nebula ballot last year, I think, which was Helena Bell's iRobot. No, just Robot, sorry. Which also takes a sort of a structure with this sort of semicolons and this language and builds up a whole story.
So if we recognize that short fiction has this ability to do these neat things, like that story, and I think, another one from last year was Selkie Stories Are for Losers, which was interesting as well. It had more narrative to it and more character to it, but it also was doing a lot of things to undermine reader perception and things like that. And I can't help but wonder if, and I read one of Brad's stories, it's really hard to condense down a really strong narrative piece into 5,000 words.
Yeah.
Almost harder in some ways than not doing it. Do you think that the internet and the emphasis on stories of 5,000 words or less has driven some of this idea that short fiction maybe isn't as narratively driven?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the so many markets I don't know when it started exactly, but when I started getting into the field, in the early aughts, that was basically the rule of thumb was 5,000 words or less. That's how you wrote a story. That's how you got into the markets because they weren't looking for anything bigger. And I think that's still somewhat true. I don't write as much for those markets, so I don't keep track of, what their lengths are and when what they're buying these days. But I think that's still true. And I think it forces, even if you're a writer like me that would like to write, more narratively, it forces you into cutting a lot. You have to start picking and choosing really what your story is going to be about. You just can't include all the same stuff that you might include otherwise. And I found myself, frankly, not liking that length quite as much. My natural length for a short story is more like 7,500 to 9,000 words. I felt like I could tell a story that I wanted to tell in that sort of, length. And that's not to take anything away from shorter stories. I mentioned Kij. She has some shorter works that I just loved, I've adored. And I'm so impressed with people that can use economy, to great effect. But I'm just not one of them typically that can do it.
Tina, do you think that markets drive these things?
That's a really interesting question. I admit I haven't been really market focused in my short story career so much. It seems to me to be the place where I've played around a lot and then tried to hunt for a market, which is probably not such a useful strategy in the long run, but that seems to be the only way I know how to write short stories.
Yeah, and I don't know how markets can't drive it when the short story market for science fiction and fantasy is frankly so small. I mean, there's just not that many markets out there, and there's not that many people that are reading, a lot of them. I mean, each individually might have, many thousands of readers, but a lot of the same folks are kind of reading the stuff from Asimov's as they are FNSF and Clark's World and so on. And there are some specialized ones like Beneath Ceaseless Skies we mentioned earlier and such, but yeah, I think it can't help but be that way a little bit. When I was at Clarion too, Kelly Link, mentioned the industry, the art, the genre, science fiction and fantasy, sort of having a conversation with itself, or, which it can do because it is small enough. Like somebody writes something, and then other people respond to it and write something that's, I don't know, not a response piece necessarily, but it's, they were affected by it, or they're writing against it in some way, their own take on it, which is, I think, is kind of neat, you know, that we can do that.
Sometimes very directly, like Cory Doctorow had that series where he was writing like iRobot, and there are more like that he was just switching the name of the title a little bit and writing a whole new story. And then there was, there was this story by Jake Kerr recently. That was one of the Nebula nominees a couple years back, and that was directly in conversation with the story where, you know, the girl's taken out. The girl is a stowaway aboard the ship. Help me out here. I have the internet. I can find this story. The girl's a stowaway aboard the ship, you know, and she has to be jettisoned because they're out of fuel. It's classic.
I do. Yeah. And they had to cut off her leg or something, right, to
get the weight down. They didn't think of that, I don't think.
That was what they should have thought of when I was, yeah, so I was talking to somebody.
Wow, you writers are screwed up. Lop her leg off.
It's better than killing her.
Yeah, the notion of science fiction and fantasy having a conversation with itself is one of the coolest parts of the field, and one of the most disturbing at the same time. It's like, we're so small we can talk to each other back and forth in published works. But we see that at novel length too. Even if there's any question that, you know, Grimdark is in conversation with 80s fantasy, and now we're seeing a response to that again, I think, in a lot of ways, you know, with other writers now that are reacting against Grimdark, and we're seeing new stuff come out, and everybody's, you know, pointing fingers at one another, which is always good fun.
Yeah, but like in longer length work, though, I think you're right. I think we can have a conversation at that length too, but it is the form that can reach outside of us, you know, and go a bit more mainstream and reach the wider audience, whereas short fiction, I think, just doesn't, for the most part, unless you get something like, what was that one? Warrior Women, the George Martin one that he did recently?
Dangerous Women.
Dangerous Women. You know, things like that, where it hits a bestseller list, you know, because of some names attached to it, you know, that kind of thing. But but by and large, you know, short fiction, we're kind of talking with each other.
I'm just going to interject that Jake Kerr's story was The Old Equations, which was in dialogue with The Cold Equations. There we go.
All right. Okay.
Did you Google that?
I did. Silently.
God bless. And you. I looked up If You Were a Dinosaur, My Love, while you guys were talking about it too.
Some of it. Oh, Brad, we're come on, man! It. You need to get up with your Hugo.
I do. Ballot,
man.
You're right.
Yeah. So we talk about these. You know, you talk about the markets and how these markets can have conversations with themselves. It's interesting because you named a series of markets, Brad. And although there are other markets, I mean, you nailed quite a few of them, and they all exist now. And you'll notice if you look at the award ballots over the last couple of years. I mean, we're seeing primarily online magazines of a particular size that are publishing the vast majority of these stories. Tor.com, Clark's World, Lightspeed, Beneath Ceaseless Skies. There's a handful of others, Innerzone, Apex, what have you. But they all are all online primarily or exclusively. And I don't think there's any question that that's changed. Cause I don't know about y'all, but when I read short stories, especially online, I read anything online. If it's not formatted in a particular way, if the paragraphs aren't breaking regularly, if the language is too dense, man, I'm clicking somewhere else. Like, I don't have time for that.
Right.
And I don't think there's any question that's influencing the kinds of short fiction that we're seeing.
There is an interesting, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, but an interesting quote from Nick Mamatas a couple years ago, or several years probably by now, that I still keep thinking about. And he was saying something about, God, I'm probably totally misquoting, this will be humiliating, but about how short fiction in the days of the paper magazines, that you wanted to have it all buttoned up and neat and tidy at the end. So someone would say, hey, that was great, and I'm going to pass it on to someone else and be done. But short fiction in the internet age, you wanted to leave a sort of hook on the end. So people are still thinking about it, and they say, I want to share this and send it off and spread the word and let other people think about it too and discuss it with me.
I think that's fantastic, and post comments about it, right?
Yeah, and exactly.
I think it's possible that Nick and Neil Clark kind of invented this notion or pioneered or provided a venue for that kind of fiction with Clark's World and really pushing for it, because, you know, I think Nick's quote is very insightful, because the internet changes conversations around things. And I'm chasing this down this line of thought about how short fiction has been influenced recently. And what we're seeing is, because I have a suspicion that those same forces that acted on short fiction when the online magazine became a thing, that there's some new things that are pushing into the short fiction field and changing the way that maybe it's being written. And I would theorize that those are crowdfunding and the ebook publishing platforms that are available to authors, and that they're providing new access points to readers that they weren't previously available. And I can't help but notice how much short fiction is being published now that route, whether it's the direct to Kindle novella or it's all of these tons of collections that we're seeing on Kickstarter. Do you think there's a potential that we're going to see some influence from that?
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking about over the past, I don't know, year or so, especially because of my new series coming out, I'm trying to, like, when Winds of Kalakova came out, I had not done any short stories for it. And I guess things were kind of in a, I don't know if a transition is the right word, but like Kickstarter was just starting up and e-readers were popular, but, you know, they're even more popular now. And I think I'm seeing that more now, you know, like, Brian McClellan comes to mind, especially. He's got the Powder Mage trilogy, and he comes out with these like short stories or novelette or novellas, and then puts them out in between the books. And it's a great in between teaser, you know, palate cleanser between them to keep people interested, keep his name out there. And then he does these cool things where he put them as a, I don't know if it was limited. He had an initial run that was limited edition, I guess, and then kind of had an unlimited run after that where he hardbound them, and sold those as well, you know, and if you have a, you know, a big enough fan base, people will eat that up. You know, it's really a neat thing for them. So I think that's one of the things that is starting to happen. You know, it might have been in the past that you would write a short story and it may or may not get published if it was related to some longer works that you had. But now you can just do it yourself and go direct to the fans, which I think is really cool. You know, you might get it published somewhere, but if not, so what? You know, your market is going to be your fan base. So I think that's a really cool thing that's sort of people are taking advantage of. And I'm definitely doing that for, you know, the next series too. I got a few stories I have planned. So
when you bring up Brian's use of the interfiction, if you will,
right,
interspersed
right.
between his novels.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you do that, you're doing something that is very much like your novels. I mean, you don't want to do, you know, a philosophical think piece that might be set in the same world, but is entirely different language or form or style from your series. I mean, you want it to be a narrative piece.
Or you might.
Well, it all depends on the writer, right?
Well, you know exactly what I'm thinking of now, right? When you say that, a Slow Regard of Silent Things.
Oh, God. Well, elephant in the room, you know. a great example, Brad. No, that's a fantastic example, actually. And Tina, I don't. Are you familiar with the Slow Regard of Silent Things?
No, I'm not.
It's Patrick Rothfuss's new novella, and we all know that Pat has sold millions of copies of his Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear. And his third novel is long awaited by his fans, now going on, I think, 4 years since the last book. And who's counting? And he just put out a novella that's, I think, somewhere in the 30,000 word range. And he's selling it for $20 hardcover through DAW, his primary publisher. It's totally unique. I mean, it is a short fiction piece about language. There is no narrative to it to speak of. It's basically the story of a girl's week.
And more to your point, like a huge departure from his other work.
Yeah, massively huge departure. I mean, it's not even fan service, right? It's total departure.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I think this sort of interfiction can be really awesome is you can take a sort of sidestep to do something that's related to your worlds, but isn't just, another short story in between. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But those things that you can't fit into a regular sort of novel, it's just sort of the perfect place to do that kind of thing.
And what I was going to go with this was you have a, you have your trilogy, with Tor that is done now.
Yeah, just finished up in October.
Right. I have all three of them. They're on my shelf. As you've thought about that and you have some stories that you've written and you write short stories, have you ever written stories set in that world?
It's not for want of thinking about it, but it's when I sold the first of that trilogy, a month later I had our first child. So I've just been kind of working to get the three books out. So
Keeping
I
your
kept
head above
thinking, yeah, my head above water.
water.
So I kept thinking, boy, it'd be really nice if I could write it. Oh, wait, that next book's due. Okay, that one's out. Boy, it'd be really nice. Oh, next book's due, So I don't know that we'll see one of those short stories. Maybe sometime in the future when the kids are off to school.
Tina, I would like to congratulate you on the time-honored parental tradition of blaming your children for something. I am all in on this.
Thank you. I'm very good at it.
I'm all in on this. I wrote a one time I wrote a post in honor of Chuck Wendig, and I called it the top 25 reasons I'm not a writer. And many of those involved my children. So I find it to be a fully valid excuse. I'm sure all the writing gurus out there are like, there's no excuses, sit down and write. And I'm like, no, man, there's lots of good excuses.
You just swear a lot
sleep
too, in
deprivation.
honor of Chuck.
I did use motherfucker several times in honor of
Good,
Chuck.
good, man.
Yeah, I know it's required. But yeah, no, that notion of being able to write fiction, but I think those inner series fiction, those weren't around before. I mean, there was no market for those really, unless you're Patrick Rothfuss, unless you sell so many books that your publisher will put out a hardcover of a novella that is totally out of left field.
And then you look at the things that J.K. Rowling's doing right now, which I think are really interesting. I've been hearing some people saying, well, they're not really stories, but if you don't follow Pottermore or whatever, she's been releasing just little sort of tidbits about the world every few months or a couple times a year. I'm not sure how often they've come out, but like one will be in the form of a news article about, I don't know, Ginny doing something. I can't remember them all, but so they're definitely. They're little world-building pieces. You could maybe call them flash stories, maybe, but not necessarily, and that's something that there wouldn't have been any space for before the internet. These are like 400 or 500 word pieces that don't really follow any format except to sort of reveal a little bit more about a world that fans want to see.
Yeah, I thought we called that like a drug dealer.
That
Kind of seems like what she's doing, you know? It's like she's the first one's free, and then after that, keeps them coming back, keep them on the hook. No, but that's the point, right? I mean, the point is to keep your reader interested and keep them coming back. And I'm sure J.K. Rowling is no different than Brian McClelland in that. She wants to know that if she writes another Harry Potter book, she's kept all of those people totally engaged in what she's doing. And although Brian's fan base or Brad's fan base is, let's not throw numbers around, but a thousandth or
We
something of
all
her
wish we were
readership,
J.K.
right?
Rowling.
It's the principles are the same, but I guess my point is that Kickstarter, crowdfunding, and or ebook publishing platforms are opening up this market that didn't exist before. And it makes me wonder if maybe the notion of narrative, really strong narrative, short fiction, short stories in particular, we're going to see more of them because that's what that novel reader wants. And say what you want about the two markets, but there are a hell of a lot more novel readers than there are short story readers.
And that's one of the reasons I really think Tor.com, the imprint, is going to strike on something, pretty cool. At least I hope it is, because it's an untapped market in my mind. It used to be, that you might be able to sell novella-length work to, I don't know, three, four places maximum, depending on if you're science fiction and fantasy, how full they were, at the time. But I think people will like that because it gives them more story to dig into. you know, really cut their teeth on the story. But it'll be shorter, you know, with, you know, everybody has, you know, less time these days. So maybe that'll go over pretty well. At least I think it will, and I hope it does.
Well, I'm a company man, if nothing else. So
yeah, I know.
I think you're totally right, Brad. I think that the story you sent me called Irindai is basically, I suspect, because I know it's the first of three parts, I mean, that's going to be a long-form novella.
Yeah.
Of exactly that kind of market,
right.
Or that kind of idea, is that I'm going to, or it's very similar to like K.J. Parker's novellas, which are, you know, 30 to 40,000 words, and tell what is basically a complete novel. It's just done it in such a way that it's more streamlined.
Right.
And then I read Tina's short story, which was titled, yes, Moon at the Starry Diner. And, that is 3,700 words. I read it in about 6 minutes. And, which I'm sure it didn't take 6 minutes to write, but I read it in 6 minutes. And what was fantastic about that story was, unlike Brad's story is a ton about the world. And of course, I'm at an advantage because I've already read a novel that Brad set in this world three times. but I mean, there's tons of world building in there. There's tons of lush detail. I mean, this story that you wrote, Tina, starts off with like, I mean, it's almost like a
hair like a mushroom.
Yeah, it's like a psychedelic drug trip.
Yeah, right.
And I have no idea what's going on in this story, but I really enjoyed it. It's about these two people that are shape-shifting, and I have no idea what's going on. And to me, it's a really interesting contrast. They're really about, it's about a plot, it's about a character, in the same way that Brad's is, but Brad's has got all of this detail, and yours has almost none.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such an interesting contrast to me. When you write a story like that, do you have all that behind it, or are you just not even worried about all that stuff behind it? You're just writing the basic story that comes to your mind.
You know, I sort of have it by the end, but I would not call my short story process a process so much as a floundering around carving a statue in the dark. You know, I used to write a lot more short stories before I sort of tried to learn how to write novels. And I would just start with an image, and I would sort of build my story around that image and slowly, you know, sort of chink away at the statue and find out more things about that world. I tried to apply that process to novel writing, and it turned out that that was a really, really terrible way to write a novel. So I had to learn to write more linearly and more narratively when I got to novel writing. But I would say with my short stories, you know, it came from, I had this image of the girl and the bear walking through the sky, and I didn't know what was going on, and I sort of chipped away at the story until I found out.
I like that term, carving a statue in the dark. It's kind of a neat concept.
Sort of how it feels.
So now, Tina, you mentioned that you went on to write novels after sort of beginning in short fiction. Brad, I know at least you published short fiction before you published novels.
Yeah.
And Mike Cole, who's a good friend of mine, has often been heard to say, if you want to be a novelist, don't waste your time writing short fiction, because they're so different. And I think he sort of fell into that trap where somebody gave him advice to write short stories first and then write novels, and it took him a long time to move out of that and into novels. I think Mike was also a Writers of the Future winner.
Yeah, he was.
Maybe 15 years before he published a novel.
Yeah, he was in Pat Rothfuss's year, actually.
Yeah. Man, yep. Pat took almost as long to publish a novel.
But, that's true.
But it's interesting that, you know, and I'd be curious if you could, when you look at it, do you think there's value in being a short fiction writer? I mean, not, and I don't mean like writing a short fiction piece or two. Do you think it's worthwhile to become a published short fiction writer before you start writing novels?
Yeah, I absolutely think there is. You know, for my path, you know, again, was novelist first. You know, I'd written one novel I never finished, another one that I did finish, but was, you know, was not worthy of much of anything. And then that's kind of when I started going to those talks at Gen Con with Kiz Johnson and other people. But she struck me most because she mentioned that. She mentioned Writers of the Future, which I joined, Clarion, which I eventually joined too. And I think you have to go in with your eyes open. I think you have to recognize that there are things that work in short fiction that don't in long, and vice versa. And you have to educate yourself about those. You know, if you're not used to short fiction, read a bunch of it. So you can kind of tell the difference on your own. But there's a ton that translates, I think, you know, just dialogue and character building, world building, having economy, which may be more economy than you're looking for in a long work, but there are times when you want to be very spare, and the short form will teach you that. You know, and so I think there's a ton of value to it. I don't know that you should worry about it. If you don't enjoy short fiction, don't worry about it. Just stay with long fiction. But if you're interested and you try it, I mean, at least give it a try for a couple of stories. And if you do enjoy it, keep going, you know, and then just keep those differences kind of in mind as you move forward in your craft, in your short craft.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to say there's a value in trying all kinds of art forms just for the sake of trying their own art forms. So from that perspective, I always advise people to try everything, and I'm a big advocate for even trying flash fiction because you have to learn about cutting so much. But I, you know, I don't really think that you have to. It did used to be standard advice you have to publish in short fiction before moving to novels, and I don't really see that being the case at all. Honestly, I think short stories can be really great places, as Brad said, to work on dialogue and characterization, and. You know, I certainly see more, like Brad, I've read, I read your first novel and I've read some of your stories that appear in this book, and I can see what you're saying about, I think you do have sort of a novelist's eye and you have, you know, the sort of longer pace, you know, the story can breathe a little and the narrative flows. So I think, for you, I would say that there are definitely maybe more similarities between your short fiction and your longer works. And I think that that's maybe less true for me. And so I'm not sure how applicable it is person by person. It'd be kind of interesting to go around to people who are both novelists and short story writers and kind of compare and contrast and see how many are, who's got a very different style between one and the other.
Well, there's people like Elizabeth Baer that just do like everything.
Yeah.
Do it all like obscenely well, you know? Jerks. yeah, it's funny. You could tell I'm an epic fantasy reader because Brad started talking about making sure that your stories have economy, and I was like, "Yeah, man, you got to make sure those dollars and cents add up," you know. And he meant economy of words,
right?
I imagine like, "Yeah, man, those, you got to make sure that economy is included."
Your
in
your fantasy economy, yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, epic fantasy dork. So, circle back around. What we started off talking about was mentioning that you're both participating in a Kickstarter that's launching this week, and it's called 6x6. And that title feels a little bit like the title of an Alfred Hitchcock film for some reason. Either that or an extremely progressive version of Noah's Ark. Maybe both, you know? I don't know. But what is this thing? Tell me a little bit about it.
So I'll take a stab at it. So 6x6 is a Kickstarter that brings together six authors. We each bring six stories to the table. And it's not quite a normal anthology per se. We're calling it an anthology, but we're each bringing our collections. The backers will get those collections. And once we're done with the Kickstarter, we go our separate ways. We take our collections with us, and they'll never be seen in that form again. So it's kind of neat because it brings us all together, you know, in one place for this time. And then after that, you can get those collections when people publish them, you know, out on wherever, Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And we brought together, myself and Tina, of course, Brenda Cooper, Martha Wells, Stephen Gaskell, and Will McIntosh. So I tried to bring together just a real, you know, nice variety of writers, you know, so we could, you know, have a interesting set of stories that people might, you know, be interested in picking up.
Tina, how do you all know each other? Is this just like a random like game of duck, duck, goose on the internet?
You know, I already know Brenda Cooper lives in Seattle, and I've worked with her. We were doing on the Sepho readings a while back in Portland and Seattle, so that was exciting to meet up with her again. And I've been a fan of Will McIntosh's work for a long time. Yeah, so I'm really excited to see his work in it as well, and to work with him on the project.
I love his work.
Most people do if they read him. I really enjoy his stuff too. I was happy he decided to come on.
But you know, I've read 4 of Will's novels, and I've never read a short story by him, which I understand is actually what he's
known for,
right, for a long time. So
yeah,
yes, you have to go read the one about the marbles, and I have to go look up what that one's called.
type.
Google.
So you've got this this thing now, 6x6. They'll all be in one book together, or is everybody going to just sort of get like the individual collections?
Yeah, it's right. The latter. Everybody will get, any backer will get all 6 collections. And that's what will, you know, be available on,
right,
you know, the Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever afterwards. They'd have to go get all of them separately, you know, after that. So yeah, so we won't bind them together, for this collection. You know, unless there's some sneaky stretch goal that we have that might do that or something. But, for now, we're just going to have them separate.
Stapled together at Brad's copier.
Yeah, electronically stapled.
So with the exception of Stephen Gaskell, I would consider all of the folks in this group to be, at least at this point in their careers, primarily novelists.
Yeah.
And Stephen may be writing novels, but he hasn't published one yet. But you've all written short fiction prolifically at some point, it seems, at least, based on bibliographies and such. But all of you are focused on novels now.
Yeah, and even Steve is. He's doing some stuff for a couple of game. He's doing some development for games and novels and world building for that. And also he, I know him through Clarion, but we also, I invited him to a writing workshop where he brought his latest science fiction novel. So he's got things cooking for sure.
So what's the interest in doing this kind of short fiction project sort of alongside, you know, novel writing? Tina, you talked earlier about how precious time is.
Yeah.
with all the children's running around and vacations to beautiful Kansas.
Hey, now.
Oh, Kansas is beautiful.
Brilliant sunsets. When Brad pitched me this idea a few months ago, I was actually really excited because of the very thing you mentioned, which is my lack of time, because I'd been wanting to collect some of my stories for a while, and obviously I've not had the sort of necessary impetus to say, yes, I will commit to staying up until 1 a.m. several extra nights just to get that put together. No, so I was very excited to sort of have the push to finally get some of these stories collected and out there.
Yeah, and for my part, like I thought about doing something where I just put out the 6 stories myself or whatever I collected, had available at the time. But one thing is that I think Kickstarter is popular, but I think it's lost its luster a little bit. It is no longer the new thing. You know, it's still definitely a great venue to use to do a project like this and others. But I thought it would be more of a draw if I could get more folks together, and bring it out that way. And I will also mention that, like, writing for me anyway, I think for a lot of folks, it's a lonely endeavor. And it's fun for me to reach out to people and have like a group experience of some kind. And that's why I wrote a short story with Steve Gaskell. That's why I wrote one with Rob Ziegler. That's partly why I wanted to do this project, was just to have something interesting that I do outside of just me sitting at a keyboard and writing my own story by myself. It's, you know, that's why I go to conventions too, is just to be by people that like this stuff. And to do a project like this, I think will be something we'll enjoy, you know, and treasure for, you know, a while. It'll be a fun experience.
That is so true. Cause I just want to say, I've also been doing some collaborations in the last few years, and my background actually before writing was theater, which is obviously completely a collaborative art, and it's very sort of an extroverted art. You know, you go out with people and you do things, as opposed to sitting at your computer by yourself. And it's been so exciting to do, one of my collaborations is Long Distance with my friend Carolyn Yoakum. We've had several stories come out. And then the other one has been with a friend who's a local playwright and theater producer. So we sit together and we brainstorm and we collaborate and we fix our structure and we come up with better dialogue, and it's what a rush. So yeah, it's really great to actually get to sort of work on a group project with people and do this sort of this writing project all together.
So you're basically telling me this is a stand-in for going into the office.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like our little mini convention that Brad's pioneered.
Yeah, this is, see, Brad, so you're telling me if your day job wasn't from home, or you had to go into an office every day, this may never have happened.
Yeah.
That may be true.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You know, we hear that a lot, that writing's an isolating experience. Increasingly less so, perhaps, with the internet. I can only imagine what it was like for these guys 30 years ago.
Yeah, really.
You know, plugging away at their keyboards and, you know, remote
just
parts of the world.
Just sending it off, and yeah.
Yeah, because we know, like, most writers live in fairly remote parts of the world, you know, other than the ones that live in New York City. You know, it's like you go to a convention in the upper Midwest and you're like, wow, there's a lot of people here. They all live there.
There's the actual people in the Midwest.
That's right. Or, Tina, you live in Oregon, right?
I do. I live in Portland now.
So we've got a fair number in Oregon as well. So
yeah, oh my God, we have so many writers. It's great.
Yeah, it's a strange thing how that works. But yeah, no, I can totally see how this is like a great opportunity to bring people together. And look, I think it's super cool that we have the ability to do this now. You know, I think that one of the biggest reasons that that people move away from short fiction is because there's just no way to make a lot of money, or really to make any money on it, other than your initial sale to a short fiction magazine, of which there are a very limited number of sales in a month. It's hard to even get it out there. And so seeing projects like this and other methods, I think, are going to bring more people writing it, which is exciting. And the more people like you that push to publish this way or to get stories out there this way, the more people will write to put stories out this way, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's neat too, because just set aside the money for a second, you know, whatever you might make on a short story, even if it's these interfiction type things that we're talking about, just getting things out, because the traditional publishing is still on, you know, a year or multi-year cycle, you know, between novels. So it can just take a long time. So that's another reason I wanted to do something, was just to feel like I'm not, you know, yesterday's news kind of thing. Just keep my name out there a little bit.
Yeah, because you're going to be, what, 3 years, two years between novel publications?
Yeah, it'll be two years plus. Yep.
Yeah, I know Wesley Chu is going through this as well. His third novel with Angry Robot got pushed back to 2015, which meant he had no novel published in 2014.
Yeah.
Which
I'm just driving him crazy.
Yeah.
Right. If anyone knows Wes.
Yeah, no, of course. the recently full-time writer Wes.
right.
But no, it does create this pressure to constantly be relevant. And you know, out of sight, out of mind. Like, I think there's definitely that mentality that you want to make sure that you're staying in the reader's consciousness.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a double-edged sword, right? I guess, because it's like, in whose consciousness? This is like another internet issue that I love to wax poetic about. You know, it's like we have this internet community, echo chamber, if you will. And it's like, yeah, staying relevant in that is hard. Like, you have to constantly sort of, you know, it's like, unless you're Cameron Hurley and you can do 50 blog posts a month. You know, it's like, how do you stay constantly, you know, in the feed, you know? But then you look out into the world and you're like, well, what does that matter? You know, it's like, once the book is out and published, and if the publisher backs it and wants me to do well, you know, is being in the public eye or being relevant constantly important? You know, like, I don't know. Like, these are just like general questions of like a writer's madness.
Well, when you were on Speculate, Justin, we talked about like the tastemakers, right? And so, like, you know, getting bloggers and other people excited, so that, you know, these larger markets like IO9 especially, others, you know, might pick it up. And I think, you know, to me, there's like this whole ecosystem that you want to kind of like cultivate, right? So that people keep people interested and knowledgeable about what you're doing, so that when you do get something out, you have a greater chance of the spark catching, you know, and catching fire and going wider and wider and wider. So I think it's not about necessarily our sort of smaller world being excited about it and consuming it. It's about them being excited about it and it breaking outside of that world. And you increase your chances of doing that if you just keep in the, you know, in their consciousness a bit.
Tina, are all writers this calculated?
Yeah. Some of us are just trying to stay awake.
Yeah, I hear you.
Those children.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I bring it back around. Before the show started, I mentioned to Brad and Tina that my daughter's birthday was today, and we got her a fish tank. And I've just discussed how challenging it is to have a healthy fish tank. And so when Brad talks about cultivating an ecosystem of bloggers like and writers. I just had this notion of like, God, if I was a writer and the ecosystem of bloggers and the public consciousness is like a fish tank, I would probably lose my shit. Because that fish tank is a you know what. And I'm just
it's a little green already.
No, it looks great, but you know, God, acidity and alkaline levels.
Oh,
and nitrate,
yeah.
I mean, you know, my daughter's like bird dogging the thing, you know, like she's staring at it 24/7. If one fish starts to float a little bit, like,
oh man,
I gotta go into full, you know,
bad dad.
Yeah, man. She named him and everything.
You know, we were saying that writing is so solitary, and so I think it's not so much that some people are calculating, it's that there's some of us that are, you know, it's hard to see beyond the next round of edits because you're so caught up in your whatever character you're trying to make work that you're really grateful for someone like Brad to come sort of spur us on and say, let's do this thing and it'll be really fun and awesome. So, you know, it's less about calculation and more about, oh, thank God there's someone to come, you know, give me a push and get me out from behind the computer where my eyes are starting to glaze over.
I suddenly feel like Courtney Schaefer, who I look at like that. She's such a go-getter and organized and energetic and stuff.
Well, Courtney Schaefer, there's a name and there's a Kickstarter I really want to back. She needs to get that thing out and live.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we can read that third book in her trilogy, the Shattered Sigil trilogy, I believe.
I think she's early next year. I think she's shooting for.
Yeah, no, really excited for that. She's kind of I feel like she's kind of the last of the Nightshade writers who hasn't gotten her third book out yet. And she's self-publishing, and I'm really excited to see it from that debut class of
2010.
So, yeah. Well, anyway, this has been a fun podcast. We were talking about 6x6, which launches December 1st.
December 1st, yeah, that's right.
December 1st. This will publish on December 3rd, so just a few days later. People can check it out.
Yeah, I'll have all kinds of links, but you can find it easy on the search page on Kickstarter.
All right, excellent. So, Tina and Brad, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks much.
All right, this has been Rocket Talk.